Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Arthur Kleinman is a doctor's doctor who learned the hard way about his lifetime in medicine. He has been learning mainly about the limits of his heroic profession, about the difference between caregiving, which could mean surgery or writing a prescription, and care itself, which means staring into an anxious patient's view of the abyss. The Soul of Care is Arthur Kleinman's 40th book. Most of his books have soulful titles, but this one is different. It's a memoir of more than a decade after his wife and professional partner, Joan, showed first hints of Alzheimer's disease, dropping a dinner plate, panicking behind a steering wheel, sudden episodes of blindness. I asked Arthur Kleinman if we could call this the re-education of a doctor.
Well, the re-education may be of a man, because I think a lot of it has to do with the first word I had in the subtitle, husband, but also the run-up to that, which was myself. I started this book because I wanted to write about care, and I've devoted my whole life to it, and I thought all of a sudden, you know, I learned more about care, taking care of my late wife Joan, than I had ever learned reading about it or doing research on it or even caring professionally for many, many patients. Out of that, I began to sort of rethink who I was and how care threw a different light on me as a person.
There is a story here, and you're going to tell it, but I want to hear again who you are. The scrapper from Brooklyn, married to the beautiful Californian with the European taste. But not just that.
I was that. I don't think I'm that. 43 years at Harvard has erased the first part of that, the scrapper from Brooklyn. I am a guy who spends a lot of time working. And I believe in being productive. And I've worked very hard at things. I've done 40 books. But I don't regard myself as a writer. I regard myself really as a footnote, but not a totally unimportant footnote, to William James and his idea that experience is the basis for knowledge. And I think I've always been curious, fascinated, surprised, shocked by experience. And I think that's basically what I was, and I wrote a lot of it, and I put a lot of it into my teaching and into my care of patients, and I wanted to learn from them about things. And that's what makes the story so interesting, because it was only when we get to my shattering, remaking experience of caring for my wife that I realized I was just touching the experience of others and not really getting to its core. And that's why I use the term soul. When I was young, in the 40s and 50s, when you were young, soul was a word we heard a lot of. And then over the years, it sort of trickled out in importance and kept alive by W.E.B. Du Bois and the soulfulness.
And black pop music, let's say it.
Yeah, black pop music. But in the areas I traveled, in anthropology and psychiatry, academic medicine, you didn't hear this word. And I think we've lost something today by not paying attention to that word. And I take that to mean something deep and abiding emotionally and morally inside of us and inside of us together. You know, it's kind of like the idea of charisma. The best writer on charisma was Max Weber. And Weber did not say that charisma lay inside of this incredibly unusual person who had the power to influence others. He said that charisma was in the space between the person who we attributed it to and the people around him from whom he drew the charisma. And that's what I discovered in the Soul of Care, that when my presence was fully engaged, as I tried to keep it fully engaged, even against the odds, taking care of Joan, and she heroically tried to keep her presence engaged, That was at the level of the soul. And that's not where we are most of the time. And so what disturbs me, and what was the other source of the book, besides the story of my caring for Joan, was my utter astonishment at the failure of the healthcare debate to get at anything like what caregiving really is. Hmm. You cannot pick up a newspaper today without healthcare being at the center of things. But we accept the same common sense language, which is dominated by economics and by bureaucracy, talking about hurt, shock, devastation, and response to it, the emotional response to it, the moral response to it, and care as a performance, as acts, but not really a performance you're doing with the mind that it's a performance, but just the sheer acts of care, which I think those acts, feeding, ambulating, helping into a bath, doing someone's hair, dressing them, etc. I think that's like rubbing a sore shoulder in a way. You're just doing them. And when you're doing them, you're doing care. That's what care is. And when you're doing them, that's when your soul is there. And then sitting back and talking about it like we're talking now, I think the great danger is you intellectualize that, you abstract it, and it loses what is most authentic about it. Mm. And that's why I regard it as a Jamesian project, because William James, from the time I was an undergraduate to the present day, influenced me in demanding that all knowledge be seen as connected to experience.
You know, you've said to me before that William James was far and away the most important teacher that ever hung his hat at Harvard. I think of him as the greatest American writer of prose sentences, up there with his brother Henry. But we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
You're introducing yourself. I just wanted to say, Arthur Kleinman, that you have a peculiar reputation on the outside, too, as a man around Harvard. A doctor, of course, psychiatrist, but a China guy, a public affairs kind of guy. And as a writer, I mean, your books, however many, they have these extraordinary titles like A Passion for Society, What Really Matters, this book, Deep China. They're not your usual scholarly books. Here's a tiny sample from What Really Matters. You're talking about medicine again, and there's a William James connection too, but you say, given the manifest shakiness of our lives, what is surprising is that we act, think, and write as if we were in control of ourselves and our world. It is our assiduous denial of existential vulnerability and limits that is extraordinary in American culture. I mean, we're an advertising culture, we're a feel-good culture, and yet we all know that that's not even the point.
Yeah. Yeah, but we use terms that come out of that romantic, silly sensibility of commercialism and romance done simplistically, that idea of resilience. You know, we're not resilient. I don't believe in resilience. I believe in endurance. I took care of my late wife for 10 years. I endured. I endured 10 years. I had all the advantages. I had the financial support. I had the education, I had the clinical training, I had the friends, I had the network, I had the hospitals, and I barely survived. And I think that when most people talk about things in life, if you can get them to talk about the fact that there are periods of time when they barely survived, that's a much better way of understanding endurance than understanding resilience, that we're resilient, we're like rubber bands. It's too triumphal an idea. Your rubber band, you bounce back. By the way, you lost your wife, go on to the next wife, okay? I don't think it works like that.
What do you mean? How does it work?
It's in you. It's an injury. It's a opportunity in the future for redemption, for all the failures you had in the acts you wanted to do, but were never enough because the task was overwhelming.
Most doctors don't talk a great deal about all these vulnerabilities, the lived experience, pain, disablement, the illness experience, but you are in the thick of it. Where did you learn that? Where did you get that direction?
Well, I was always interested in understanding the person in their context because I was unclear about my own context. So I had two names when I was in elementary school, PS 161 in Brooklyn, because my mother ran away with me from my father when I was 1 year of age. And I kept my biological father's name, Speer, until I was adopted by my stepfather, Kleinman. But for a period of time, in the fifth, sixth, seventh, and maybe the eighth grades, I forget, I was Speer in elementary school and then Kleinman in religious school. And I went with some of the same guys. So I was uncertain about myself. Who was I, really? And, you know, why did I have these two names when no one else had two names? And as I grew up, I had a very lovely mother who died at 102 just a couple of years ago. And she kind of lost sight of me, and I sort of became careless, reckless. I was actually a problem kid on the streets. Remember, the police came to speak to my grandfather. We lived with my grandfather. And said, you got to watch this kid because he's getting into trouble. And my grandparents and my mother and stepfather decided to move out of Brooklyn when a mafia recruiter mussed my hair and said to me, kid, we've got our eyes on you. You're doing good. And those guys did end up in places like the mafia or prison or dead. And so,
what did they like about you?
Because I was kind of wild. I was careless. I didn't get crap from anybody. But what was underneath it all, I think, was just a carelessness. I didn't realize the world I was in. I didn't understand the real vulnerabilities. I didn't understand the opportunities to do things in the world to help people. I didn't understand the simple fact that you don't find wisdom unless you're engaged with others, doing things for others, in the world of others, not in trying to figure out who you are. And so that's why Chinese culture became so important to me and my wife, because we realized that there was something about doing good in the world, building things, developing a family, that was so totally opposite of where I'd come from.
Coming up, what people in chronic pain need even more than pain relief. This is Open Source. Arthur Kleinman came to understand, in caring for his wife's terminal illness, that part of the doctor's job all along was taking into oneself the hardships, the bad luck, the loneliness of his patients.
Absolutely. It started right with the beginning of medical school, and I realized it was awesome. It was awe-inspiring to have windows open on people's lives and to recognize the amount of pain they were in and that I was going to be trained in such a way to respond to this, to be able to do something here. When I was just a beginning student, I did a rotation on a rehabilitation service, and there was a little seven-year-old girl. She had been badly burned, terribly burned, on a very substantial portion of her body, and she was being debrided. They were taking the dead tissue off in a whirlpool bath, the surgical resident and the nurse. And my role was just to hold her hand. And she kept screaming and fighting this. And finally, at wit's end, I just didn't know what to do. I was so troubled, so hurt by what she was going through. I wanted to help her and I couldn't figure out how to do it. And I said, tell me, how do you stand this? And she stopped, just like that, stopped. Crying, stop yelling. And I realized all of a sudden, you could talk to people if you showed you were genuinely interested, you were intensely interested in them, about what really hurt them, what bothered them. I think pain patients taught me an enormous amount. Patients with chronic pain. And these were totally debilitating pains. So you found people who just could not get out of this pain. And if you ask them to describe how bad is the pain, they would say the pain is 15 on a scale of 1 to 10. You know, when you hear that and you realize you've just seen a cancer patient who tells you the pain is 8, you realize they're trying to impress you with just how terrible the pain is, because the problem with chronic pain, people don't believe them. That's the worst thing that can happen with any kind of illness experience, or in my mind, any kind of authentic experience, that others don't seem to believe you.
Can I say, Arthur Kleinman, you're telling me things about yourself that other people have sort of said about you in different ways, that the important thing about Arthur Kleinman is not what he knows, but what he's experienced.
I think a lot of it actually comes out of my anthropology. If you go to a village in Taiwan or an urban area in China, and on the surface, they look radically different from the United States. But as soon as you get into them, you realize that underneath the superficial difference is a superficial similarity. And that the real issue is a deep difference, which you don't see on the surface, and goes way beyond the similarity. And that deep difference is that different things are at stake for people. So for Chinese, in interaction with people, there's often loss of face, fear of loss of face. That's the worst thing, traditionally, that a Chinese would experience, that someone would humiliate you. So much of that culture, Chinese culture, is meant to protect people from humiliation and protect them from losing face. In the United States, that is not the issue. Nothing shames you. Okay? That's our own moral take on things. We've developed different things that are at stake.
I think of anthropologists as sort of reporters with a PhD, but what is the method?
Oh, I think it's curiosity and recognition of difference and a realization that difference should be applauded and that it needs to be understood from in its own terms. And also the recognition, I think this was the recognition that the great German-American anthropologist Franz Boas had, that we're all different, not just across societies and ethnic groups, but within all these groups, that it's difference that is the human phenomenon, that we're different from each other. And crossing that realm, being interested in it, and wanting to know, well, what's your life like? And realizing that, Chris, your life and my life, they're not the same. And that your inner life and my inner life, if we could expose them, get at them, would teach us that there are different things at stake, even for people who look on the surface pretty similar. Boston intellectuals, people interested in William James and reading widely. But when you get to the inner life, differences.
When did you come to see, as you instinctively do now across the board, medicine as a culture, as a cultural system, a network of ideas and people operating in a peculiar way, sometimes well, sometimes not?
Oh, I saw that, I think, through very practical experiences. When I was an intern in internal medicine at Yale, a young boy died on the service that I was the intern on, and I interacted with him and his parents, and he had a very unusual liver disease. And the professor of liver diseases, who was a world-renowned guy, came down and said to me, Kleinman, we need to get an autopsy because it's very important to get the liver and see what's going on in it. And I said, well, I'd be careful about asking for an autopsy right now, because the family is in the room there and they're terribly upset. And he said, no, no, we're going in there, we're going to ask for it. He literally pulled me, yanked me by my white coat. We went to this room and there was this terribly upset family. And he said to them, I'm really sorry that this happened to your son, et cetera, but you've got to understand that he had a really rare liver disease and we've got to get the liver out before it rots. Okay? And the family just went bananas. So here was a guy who had no interpersonal skills and completely missed the boat. And then something terrible happened, which was, as they shouted at him, got very upset, he pulled me around the corner, again, by the lapels of my white coat, and he thrust in my hand two Vim Silverman needles. These were needles used to biopsy the liver. And he said, you get in that room, lock the door, and biopsy the liver. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I said, I'm not. You heard the family. And he said, Kleinman, you're going to do that. You get into that room and you biopsy. I said, I'm not doing it. He said, I can have your goddamn job. And I told him, no, you can take my goddamn job. I said, we got into this argument. And then finally, after browbeating me enough, I took the two needles, went into the room, biopsied the liver, dropped it off at the liver lab. There was no space in medicine at that time to talk about ethics. There were no ethics rounds. There were no issues that were labeled as ethical specifically. You couldn't talk about this. And when we were at a clinical pathological conference together, he praised me for getting the liver samples, and I felt this sleaziness. And then instead of blaming myself, I said, you know, this was not me. I may have had a failure of nerve at that point and did something cowardly by going against my own intuition. But this is systematic. This is the bullying that takes place in medicine. This is the authoritarian structure of medicine. This is its power relationships. And it's the power relationship not just with patients and with families, but with young doctors and senior doctors. Now, a great deal of that has changed. But the early part of my experience, that was part of understanding, well, what is this culture of medicine? And I got at this by expanding and popularizing a distinction made by a teacher of mine at Yale, a remarkable epidemiologist by the name of Alvin Feinstein. And he had made a distinction between disease and illness. He had made a distinction for research purposes. And I picked up on this, that illness was the experience the family and the patient had of the symptoms and their consequences, and also their attempt to do something about it, like seeking help. But disease meant the pathology. And for the doctor trained in medicine, when you spoke to him, you were speaking out of the world of illness, but she or he was listening for the disease. Mm. And hence, there was almost a misalignment, as it were, that the concern of patients was with their pain, their shortness of breath, the difficulty that the shortness of breath made for walking up a flight of stairs, the fact that they couldn't have or were afraid to have sexual intercourse anymore because it brought on further symptomatology. But for the doctor, that was not it at all. It was shortness of breath. And what does shortness of breath connect with? Connects with asthma, heart failure, a variety of other disorders. Trying to figure this out was figuring out the disease pathology. Mm. That's critical. If you didn't have that, it would be like going to a mechanic who couldn't help you, okay? But a doctor, in my mind, should have been more than a mechanic. He or she should have been interested in the illness experience, not just the disease pathology.
Arthur, you've been a lifelong student of the subtleties and the overtones and the emotions inside medical care and caregiving, and yet you're also saying that you learned most of what you know in the last 11 years of your wife's suffering with Alzheimer's. Introduce your wife and then the calamity.
Yeah. Well, let me introduce my wife and actually the way that I first met her. I was a second-year medical student at Stanford. I was really bored with what I was learning. And I saw there was a film series on Thursday night, French and Italian films. But I went to the wrong place. And just in front of me was a young woman who had also gone to the wrong place. And she was asking the fellow, well, where is it playing if it's not here? And he said, Cubberly Auditorium, which was at the Ed School at Stanford. And she said, I don't know that place. And then all of a sudden, it just came out of me, and I wasn't like that. I said, I'll show you the way. And actually, that became our conjugal myth later on. And so as we walked to the Cumberly Auditorium, I realized I was with an exceptionally beautiful woman who looked very much like Audrey Hepburn, with her hair in a chignon, pearls on, just a beautiful woman. And I was dressed like almost a hippie medical student, with a shirt torn at the elbow, with, I forget, jeans or loosely fitting pants. And as we walked, and she told me she was working as a research assistant at the Hoover Institute at Stanford for a Chinese economist, I said, could I take you out for a coffee? I'll never forget this, because I don't think anyone's ever done this to me before. She sort of looked me up and down like this. You could see there was a real hesitancy in her mind. I thought, this woman doesn't see me for who I am. She sees me as a poorly dressed medical student. She said, all right. I had clearly fallen head over heels in love with her. And from there, it just developed, and her parents were dead set against the marriage. Turned out they were a family that did not like doctors, did not believe in medicine. And here I was, a medical student. They also were not happy that their daughter was with a Jewish medical student. And my family was just as dead set against it. And after a year, we married. And we were married for almost 46 years. Mm. She was so impressive, Joan. First of all, people commented on her beauty, always. And she was remarkable with language. Had great French, and she had incredible Chinese, incredible Chinese. It was not just her fluency, but her tones. Her tones were so aesthetically right.
And how had that happened?
Because she had studied Chinese. She had studied assiduously Chinese, beginning with an interest in Chinese art and Chinese history, and then developing. And we spent these years in Taiwan and then later China. We lived for about 7.5 years, first in Taiwan, then in China. Our kids spoke Chinese. We spoke Chinese. I've never been good in language, but my Chinese became good enough that I could treat patients in Chinese. My world changed entirely, and it developed around things that I had never paid attention to. Like, for example, Joan was convinced that it was at the dinner table that you built the values she wanted to see built: aesthetic appreciation, commitment to being present and interactive with each other, being intellectually lively. And we did this with the kids, and we were as poor as church mice. And she would have candles with our dinners. She would assign us, as it were, almost topics that we would, you know, talk about at dinner. She was a fantastic reader, and we read to the kids constantly. When we crossed country for me to take my first tenure job at the University of Washington, 1976, we read War and Peace to a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Good for them. You're traveling, you're writing, you're treating people in various places, you're teaching. How did Joan fit into that sort of hurly-burly of a professional life?
We did it together. So Joan, whose field was classical Chinese, started by doing her work, and I was doing my work, but increasingly she began to do research with me, and we ended up being collaborators. And so our offices were next to each other at Harvard. Joan was much better at personal relationships than I was. So we had all these students. By now I have had more than 100 PhD students, more than 200 postdoctoral fellows, you know, hundreds and hundreds of undergraduates. She was fantastic with them. And in the early days, when I was really demanding and caught up with my own need to get my work out and may have been short with people, she bridged the relationships. And she was the one, you know, who they came to love, much like I loved her. They respected me. They worked with me. I was their mentor, but they loved Joan, just like me. And then, you know, over time, she took on enormous burden of things, which when I talk about today, it's almost inexplicable. And the only way I can not make myself sound like an idiot in letting her have take on this burden is that it was a different era, and I was not woke. I was not liberated. And so Joan did everything.
Like
preparing the greatest meals, paying the bills, deciding on the big things and the little things, you know, what house we were buying, taking care of the garden. She was a fantastic, constant gardener, taking care of the kids. And it freed me up to do all this work, and she wanted me to be doing all this work. But it was only when she got sick that I started doing things I should have been doing for decades before: paying the bills, calling the plumbers, working, you know, with the garden, keeping things going. So to begin with, caregiving for me was simply taking on the tasks that I should have taken on long before. And then slowly, those tasks became bigger and bigger.
Were there no bad days before that sort of telltale slip?
Yeah, sure, sure. Occasionally there were. When I was too obsessed with my work, and Joan felt I wasn't paying enough attention to her and the kids, she'd get angry at me. And she showed her angry. She showed her anger in a very interesting way. She never, ever exploded with sort of wild emotion. She had a steely way of expressing anger. She'd reach across, grab my glasses, and slowly crush them in her hand.
Oh, my word.
She did that twice.
Do I have your attention now, Arthur?
Oh, yes, she did. And so, you know, for me, I had this great sense that I owed her everything. And hence the beginning of doing the caregiving, as it were, I felt I was doing what I should have done in the past. And if anything, I began to realize I enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed cooking the meals. I enjoyed planning what the meals would be through the week. I enjoyed cleaning the house. I enjoyed all these things. So I felt I owed it to her. And also, I was finding myself in the actions themselves, feeling like I was keeping the house going. It was a great feeling.
Coming up, this curious process of becoming the person we care for. This is Open Source. The Soul of Care is Arthur Kleinman's account of doctoring his wife of 40-some years through Alzheimer's disease. The spookiest part came early when only Joan seemed to know what was coming.
It was one Saturday. I stopped to tie my shoes, and all of a sudden I saw a pickup truck coming from the side. She never saw it. And it ran over her foot. Thank God it didn't. It would have killed her if it had hit her. Just ran over her foot, and she had a fracture of the ankle, had to have titanium screws put in. It sort of so shook her confidence that after that, she wouldn't walk places without me, without holding on to me and the like. So we knew there was something was terribly wrong. At the beginning, we had sort of waved it away and said, you know, that was part of aging. But she was only 59. And my mother at that time, who was in her 90s, didn't have any of these problems. So we knew something was wrong. And we went to someone who was a great diagnostician at Harvard Medical School, and someone I knew, a really outstanding person. And he made the diagnosis, atrophy of the brain, which he saw. She had had many, many MRIs and CT scans, and he saw it for the first time, that her brain was atrophying, and that the likely diagnosis was early onset Alzheimer's disease.
Hmm. What does that do to the husband caregiver?
So that really shook us up. And that night, Joan said something to me that I'll never forget and was the most difficult thing I ever heard from her. And she said, I will not linger.
Hmm.
You, and then she mentioned the name of our primary care physician, you'll know how to end this. You will not let me linger. I will not be in some terrible condition going on and on. You'll bring it to an end. And we both wept, and I realized I would do everything, but I couldn't possibly bring it to an end for her. And I realized that we would, in some terrible way, endure the unendurable.
Hmm.
And you know, Chris, over 10 years, that experience became unendurable.
Hmm. You write about the caregiving relationship almost as a new stage in your lives together. You have a line about this existential thing about caregiving. What did you mean?
I meant that it was sort of the most basic of human actions and engagements. Someone is hurt, injured, and you do something for them. You react, you help them, you respond. It seems to me that that is about as basic as you can be in life, and that this is the social glue that holds life together. And if anything is existential, this is existential. Mm-hmm. But we don't talk about that. We talk about existential angst. Camus wrote about suicide being the existential issue. But I don't think that's the existential issue. The existential issue is caring for others and facing how much do you care for another.
Hmm.
I'm teaching a course right now that's called Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Cares? And who cares is a kind of an irony. Do you care enough to do the things another needs and wants? Where's the line drawn? How do you protect yourself in a setting like that?
Mm.
Do you get overwhelmed? Are you so thoroughly enmeshed that the other's pain is your pain?
Mm.
And in caring for the others, you're caring for yourself. That's how I felt. And I saw also that where most of us intellectually think that the locus of care is the hospital, the clinic, that's wrong. The locus of care is the family. Most care is given in the family, raising kids, responding to illnesses, taking care of disability, responding to injury, all helping people in their lives, loving another person. All of that is care. And hence there's a difference between care and caregiving.
And what is it?
Caregiving can be done in a almost remote, bureaucratic way without paying much attention to the other person as a person and just going through the motions.
Mm.
And care is something else. Care is doing those things but not avoiding the emotion. It's the presence, your presence with another. It's the engagement. That's what care is. Mm. It's the doing. And it's the being present in the doing. It's the message, I'm with you in this. I'm here to help you. I'm going to do what I can to help. Long ago, when I trained in medicine in the 1960s, I think this was the commonly expected role of the doctor, okay, that you convey to the patient that that person meant something to you and you're going to be there for them.
Hmm.
And then over time, I think a combination of big business and big government has bureaucratized things so that physicians have internalized a very different ethic, a very different way of morally being with people, which is simply get the disease treated, go on to the next person. In the worst of settings, it's seeing the patient as a profit center and just generating income. And you know what? It starts in medical school. We have evidence now that graduating medical students are worse at empathic acts and history taking and the psychosocial aspect of caring than our first-year medical students. That's a terrible finding. A terrible finding for a medical educator, because it means that side by side with filling medical students up with the enormous amount of technological knowledge that they master, we seem to be de-skilling them as human beings.
As they go. This is one of four paradoxes you write about toward the end of this book, The Soul of Care. I'd love you to tick through them as fast as you can. One is that the patient is peripheral. Not only the doctor is looking at the computer, but the patient is almost incidental to his preoccupation.
Yes.
Second, the old rule, the nurses will tell you your condition ahead of the doctor, that the nurses and the assistants are doing a great deal of the work. Third, that education is a downward process. It debilitates the zeal or the insight or the empathy that students enter with. And finally, that incredible technology, in fact, undermines caring.
Yeah. The paradox to begin with is that if you go and give a lecture, as I frequently do in a medical setting, and you say, so look, we're doing such a poor job of care, why don't we reconfigure medicine and medical education and just say, we don't do any care.
Hmm.
We're like mechanics, high-level mechanics. We take care of the disease pathology, we give the treatment, and we'll turn it over for care to other people. Okay? As soon as you say that, a quarter of the audience raises their hand in disbelief that you would make any kind of statement like that. Usually it's the professor of medical education and other people who say, this is nonsense. That's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. And you're sitting there, you're taking all this, and you say, gee, it's interesting you hear you respond. Now tell me, how much time do you actually put into the curriculum? And how much money do you put into getting professors who can teach this stuff?
Mm.
And then there's a kind of a silence. And you end up with a sad feeling, and usually people come up to me at the end and say, you know, Arthur, it's great to see you fight the good fight, but the game is lost, okay?
That's a common response.
Yeah. You fight the good fight, but you know it's already lost. It's too late now. But I think that for the United States, we can do this.
What's the key?
A lot of it is rethinking what medicine is about. The very selection process of medical students should emphasize qualities of empathy, communication, skills in interpersonal relations, just as much as it emphasizes qualities of intellectual achievement.
Mm.
We've got to start with who do we select to be physicians. I remember once taking a group of Harvard medical students around one of our hospitals and interviewing patients, and then we would talk about the interview and the patients. And finally, one of the students said to me, you know, Dr. Kleinman, we're the wrong students for you. We've been selected on the basis of our cognitive skills and our intellectual interests. The right people for you are people who are really interested in caregiving. And I was kind of shocked to hear this. But I think this is a very honest statement. And I think we should begin by saying, well, you know, we want people who are going to be caregivers to be the people we select for medical school. There also are aspects of caregiving that no one is going to assist you with. How do you handle the sadness you have? How do you deal with the anger? You know, you get so frustrated and angry, the most important thing is learning how to prevent yourself from taking the anger out on the person who is so vulnerable before you, that person who is has dementia or some other reason for being a frail elderly person.
Mm.
Controlling those feelings, frustration, anger, sadness, in order to be able to get on with the work of care, that's the wisdom of learning how to live a life. That's what I meant when I said that I had no wisdom. I had plenty of knowledge, but no wisdom about how to live a life, I think, until I met Joan. Joan gave me a lot of the wisdom for living, but I got the wisdom from care, not so much out of my own experience of being a caregiver professionally with my patients, but in being a family caregiver for Joan.
Learning anew as you went.
Learning as I went.
I'm wondering, you know, how do you apply those last days wisely to your earlier practice? I'm thinking of those two questions that Atul Gawande poses in his book on being mortal for people who are terminally ill. They're marvelous. One, do you know your condition? Do you know where you're at?
Right.
And secondly, what do you want for yourself in the time remaining? To me, the gorgeous thing about those questions are they apply equally to a teenager, a healthy teenager. Do you know what the possibilities of your life really are? And secondly, where would you like them to take you?
Philip Larkin, the great English poet, once wrote, "To find words at once true and kind, or at least not untrue and not unkind."
Mm.
And I think to be able to put together that sharing of information and that truth, that desire for truth, along with support, with the sense that you're not alone in this, that we've got these resources that can help you, that people will stay with you in this. And the message that is not a demoralizing message. I think that we ourselves in our society may have gone over too far on the idea of absolutely revealing everything about the illness.
Was there anything you hadn't learned by the time Joan died? Any important things that you could have done differently in retrospect?
Yes, well, I think that anyone who takes care of someone else for 10 years recognizes many points of failure. And a number come to my mind. I remember once that when Joan was far along in her dementia, I took her to
The Metropolitan
Opera.
Yes.
Well, she loved the opera. I loved the opera. And I have a cousin who got tickets for Don Carlo, and it was one of her favorite operas. And in retrospect, I probably should not have taken her because her dementia was so severe that while the opera was going on, she couldn't control herself, and people got annoyed and angry around us. But on the other hand, I felt, you know, it was such a terrible problem. This was one of the sources of joy for her. So I'm not even sure now, thinking back, whether I wouldn't take her again. But I did expose her. So that's my point, that I at times exposed her to feeling assaulted by her illness and by others because I wanted to normalize it and not so completely change our lives that I was protecting her at home all the time. It's important to get the right balance. That's my point.
You began with William James. I'm wondering, Arthur Kleinman, at the end of this, what was it that William James somehow understood in a fashion that lets him still preside over our understanding?
So William James said, we should not be afraid of life. I think that's incredibly important. He himself went through serious psychological threat. And he knew what that sense of being afraid of life was. And he said it was crucial not to be afraid of life. His emphasis on finding meaning in life, that moral core of life, that you've got to find meaning in life. And that meaning may be caught up in all kinds of difficulties and the like, but it's the finding and living with that meaning that is crucial. You know, it seems to me that William was the great writer. He said all these things, right? But Henry was the great psychologist.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay?
And Henry, you remember, said in the short story, The Middle Years, it's an elderly writer who's dying, being taken care of by a young doctor. The writer intuits that the young doctor has a secret. The secret is the young doctor wants to be a writer. And as he dies, this writer, this elderly writer, tries to convey a truth about both writing and, I think, medicine and life to the young doctor. And he says, if I get it more or less right, we work in the dark. We do what we can. We give what we have. Our passion is our doubt. And passion is our responsibility. And I think that recognition that we're always doubting, that am I good enough at doing this, at this care? Can I do this? Nonetheless, cannot overwhelm that passion we have to do something. And in my view, it's to do something for others. And this is where I think the moral genius of the Chinese has been to understand that it's through others that you do something for yourself. You discover yourself through others. You, in building for others, in assisting, you build yourself. And it's not just the care of the person. It's the care of a family. It's the care of children. It's the care of the garden. It's the care of our planet. It's the care of our neighborhood. All those acts humanize the world.
Arthur Kleinman, you have met all our expectations of a great teacher, great talker, great writer, a great caregiver. Thank you for the soul of care, and thank you for this conversation. Arthur Kleinman's book is titled The Soul of Care, The Moral Education of a Husband and a Doctor. Open Source is the work of caring producers Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman and our engineer George Hicks. Mary McGrath wrote our diagnostic and statistical manual. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.